We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Show, episode 133.
On today's show, we talk about the real paleo diet, a headless statue, and a mummified sheep.
Let's dig a little deeper. Welcome to the show, everyone. How are you enjoying this desert rain?
It's weird, but different.
Yeah. It's crazy. It's beginning of July last week, and we've had a lot of rain.
Yeah, so much more rain than we usually get. Enough so that we were like rained out in the field last week, which is so unusual.
Yeah, so we waited a few days to let it all dry out so we could finish the project.
Yep.
And then it rained again.
Yep.
So hopefully. Who knows what it's going to look like tomorrow.
Well, it does dry fast, so hopefully it's okay when we go out to finish tomorrow.
That's right. So we don't have Paul. He is currently on his way back to his home in the northeastern United States. And we are down here in Nevada still and getting ready to take off. But before that, we have some news articles for you. This first one's kind of a long one. And to be honest, I mean, it was written not too long ago, like a week ago. And I feel like just some of the stuff I've seen, even some of the stuff they've linked to. First off, the article is very comprehensive and mm-hmm. It's like a meta study. And they talk about everything related to the paleo diet. And they reference a lot of peer-reviewed primary sources.
Yeah.
They also reference themselves in some other articles they've written. And a lot of this stuff has come from, you know, stuff that's been written in the last like 6 months. Mm-hmm. So take that for what it is.
Yeah. Very, very thorough article, though, as far as, you know, these sorts of things go. So right. I was pretty impressed by that.
So this was written on inverse.com, something I never really heard of, mm-hmm. in their science section. And it's called The Real Paleo Diet: Scientists Debunk Ancient Food Myths. Now, there's not really any debunking going on in the article. They're just talking about reality in ancient times, quote.
Nah, that was an attention grabbing title, I think.
Yeah. Totally. So anyway, well, a lot of people think the paleo diet is, you know, very few grains and things, lots of fats, mm-hmm. and meat and stuff like that, because they say, well, if it was good for people in the Paleolithic, they were always healthy and, you know, they made it through and they didn't have processed foods and sugars and, you know, unnatural sugars and stuff like that. You know, the reality is a little bit different.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, first off, we're going to talk about a bunch of things here, but I think the thing people need to remember is people in Paleolithic times also burned way more calories on a daily basis than we ever will.
Yeah, they needed super high calorie diets, high fat diets, in order to get all the work done that they had to do just to survive life. So it's very different what they were eating back then compared with our diets now, for sure.
Yeah. So there's a lot of different sections to this article. They go all over the place. The first section talks about basically ceramic baby bottles in the shapes of animals that were found in 1200 BCE to 450 BCE Bavarian graves, basically.
Right.
They found these. They're shaped like animals.
Yeah.
I don't know what else to say. The pictures are really cool.
Yeah, they're so cute. I mean, it's clearly done for the entertainment of the child who would have been drinking out of the bottle.
Right.
Kind of like, you know, the airplane spoon, right?
Yeah.
That's what it reminds me of.
Yeah, and a lot of times I'm a little skeptical when they make observations like that. They're like, well, it made us laugh, so it probably made children of the time laugh, you know, and it amused them. And I'm like, you know, yeah, that actually probably is true in this case.
Yeah.
Because why would you go through the effort of shaping it like this thing, which couldn't have been too easy? Mm-hmm. You know, shaping it like an animal, making it hollow, of course, to hold milk. And then, you know, using that milk to actually, they didn't have like a sucking mechanism, but I'm sure they would have drank out of it out of the end.
Yeah. They didn't really have like a nipple like bottles do today. But it said that some of them use the tail as the sippy end of it, basically. So I don't know. It does seem likely that they made it for the entertainment of the child, because what is your goal, right? Is to get enough food into the body of your child that you're trying to nourish and grow. And if making them smile and laugh and more willingly drink, drink whatever you're trying to give them, then that's what you got to do. So I get it.
So what does this show us about what they ate back then? Well, what it shows us is the milk that was found inside these things, the fatty residues of the milk, the lipids, if you will, were from other animals.
Yeah.
Yeah. So moms were supplementing milk because I'm willing to bet that, you know, they didn't have a pump, like a breast pump.
No, they wouldn't.
I mean, I guess you could squeeze the boob and get some milk out, but you would. There's no way to store it. And why would you do that if the baby can just go right to the boob?
Yeah.
So they must have used these almost exclusively, I would say, for
weaning other probably. Milk.
Yeah.
Yeah. I doubt they would have put breast milk in there. Human breast milk. Yeah. That wouldn't have made sense to do that.
Right.
So this is probably a way to help wean the child off the breast, basically, and still get a little bit of milk into them and the nourishment that you get from milk. So that's probably what the goal was. It was probably for older children too, because like a really young infant's not going to be able to handle the bottle like that. And so I would guess it's for, you know, more toddler age kids that are weaning.
Right. So, yeah. Of course we don't know, you know, culturally when they would do that.
No, that's just a guess on my part from what I know about modern children, but it definitely, there's a lot of different things that we could assume or guess here. So, yeah.
What was that movie where the kid was like four and
still breastfeeding?
And the one dad goes to the other dad. He's like, oh, how's your son? As he's like breastfeeding on the mom. He's like 48 months. I don't know who that was.
I think it was Vince Vaughn, but I don't remember which movie it was.
That was pretty funny. I feel like if the kid can ask for the milk out of the boob, they're probably too old.
You are making some...
I mean, that's just in our culture. I mean, that's a judgment that people would make.
There are very, very strong feelings about breastfeeding and breast milk, and we don't have children, so I'm just going to end the conversation there because we're not interested in getting into an argument about what... And how people breastfeed their children.
And this isn't an argument. It's more of a discussion about, you know, back in the day, could children have breastfed until they were like 8 or 9 because food sources are scarce?
No, they absolutely could have. Right? Yeah, they absolutely could have.
That's what I'm saying. It wouldn't have been like a weird thing because it's just a source of food and nutrition. Right. You know? So anyway, the cool thing about all this is, you know, evidence of what people actually ate is a lot more difficult to come by than you would think.
Yeah.
Right. A lot of times we see like bones and things in fire pits, and you make the assumption that they ate that stuff, but you don't have like direct evidence that they ate that stuff.
Yeah. And it often in the past hasn't really been considered super important either.
Right.
And that might be in part because we didn't have the technology to analyze the microscopic remnants in these bowls. So that might have been part of it, but also it just wasn't the focus of past archaeologists.
Right.
Until somewhat more recently, I guess like the last 30 years or so.
Yeah, back in the day, they were more concerned with getting museum quality pieces and taking the little sherds and things that might have some good lipid analysis potential and just tossing them or not collecting them or something like that. So, and then the museum quality stuff just like went in the museum.
Yeah.
So.
Chances are it was like cleaned too.
Oh, yeah.
You know, probably. Like 100 years ago, they would be cleaning these things before displaying them. So any residue that could be tested is probably long gone. But, you know, fragments of sherds could still potentially have things on them. So,
yeah. Another point that the article author makes is that also back in the early archaeologist times, people were more concerned about, you know, kings and probably queens and conquering warriors and people who were, you know, I guess important, so to speak, to the time period, and they were less concerned about the day to day.
Yeah.
And mothers and women are just, you know, they are the day to day.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of that stuff was overlooked. And they say right in the article that artifacts from food prep belong to those that lacked societal power, which are typically women, servants, slaves.
Yep.
You know, people like that. So there just hasn't been a lot of activity on that.
Yeah.
So.
It's good to shine a spotlight on that because I don't think you can truly understand a society, a past society or culture, unless you have the whole picture and you know what every member of that society was doing, what they were responsible for and how it all fit together. It's a big puzzle and you can't just look at the edge pieces. You know, you got to have the middle bits too.
Yeah. So one thing that changed everything about cooking for the early humans was earthenware, pottery.
Yes.
And part of that was because, well, they were now able to boil things, make stews, you know, store stuff inside of it for long periods of time without you know, bad things happening to it. You can't like store something inside of the crook of a tree branch or something right. like that. Like it's going to go bad.
Right.
And residue analysis has really changed things too, because organic residues, especially fats, cling to the little nooks and crannies of pottery fragments.
Right.
And they just kind of make their way in there, especially if you're boiling it.
Mm-hmm.
So I would imagine some of the early ceramics were just like, you know, they started boiling it over the fire and it just like leaked out like a sieve probably.
They had to get their technique right. Get the firing temperature correct and all that to get a full. Yeah.
Yeah. It notes in here because there's a lot of different segments talking about different things, but medieval people, and the medieval is a very specific kind of time frame. We were talking way earlier before that, but like medieval people, you know, maybe 1,000 years ago, give or take, we're making stews, cheeses, butters. I mean, that sounds pretty delicious. And it sounds like I would have been fatter back then. So
I don't know. You would have been working your ass off.
That's true. See, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Like I spent most of my day today. We're recording this. It's like 6 o'clock in the evening. We haven't had dinner yet. And yeah, I haven't eaten that much today, but I feel like I've spent the entire day sitting.
Yeah.
Because I've been on calls, mm-hmm. computer work. Yep. And yeah, I went for a swim this morning. That's the only calories I burned.
Yeah.
Really. So.
Yeah, definitely. That's modern society right there. So. That's right.
Anyway, one of the things that helps make this all happen is the residue analysis. And the way that they do that, not to get too deep into the weeds here, is they use two techniques. Well, the first one is called gas chromatography. And that's essentially, we're not going to get into what that exactly is, but essentially that's used to detangle, so to speak, the molecular structure of whatever they put in the gas chromatograph, I guess it would be.
Mm-hmm.
So that helps to say, okay, so this is this, that's that, and then we can collect all these things. And then they take those molecules and they put them in a mass spectrometer, and mass really does mean mass, like mm-hmm. weight. And well, weight is different than mass, but mass, not like a lot, but mass as in, you know, weight.
Mm-hmm.
And molecules, different molecules are have very defined weights. And so when they take those molecules, they detangle them with the gas chromatography, and then they take the mass spectrometry or the mass spectrometer, and then they can tell what it is.
Yeah. So it's really cool.
I mean, they can get down to the, you know, I think there's a lot of experimental archaeology here that we haven't talked about.
Yeah.
And they did a lot of really cool things like cooking and storing and all kinds of mm-hmm. stuff. And one of the ones that was interesting was cabbage. They boiled cabbage.
Yep.
And the fats or whatever that are in
the waxy coating on cabbage. Yeah, yeah. You know how it's like slightly waxy on the outside?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like they were able to take that and say, oh, yeah, this is definitely cabbage.
Yeah. Yeah.
When they found out what it was.
Yep. That waxy coating was there and they were able to identify it, which is really neat. There's a lot of other stuff that they were able to identify with much more certainty than you would expect. It was pretty surprising, but really neat.
Yeah. You know, one thing that I thought was interesting too, that I didn't know, labs like this use a lot of milk proteins to do certain analytical techniques.
Yeah.
They said that, contamination is a real problem. And in fact, people have claimed evidence of dairy products before on sites, but it was actually contamination.
Oh,
yeah. So because labs that in general do this mm-hmm. apparently use milk proteins for lots of different things. I don't mm-hmm. really know why. I don't know the chemistry behind that.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how it works. Yeah. But
that was interesting. It just tells you that there's two ways that you can really go wrong with these types of analyses, whether it's residue analysis or, you know, any other type of analysis where you're looking at something that's on the artifact. Mm-hmm. The first one is in the collection.
Yeah.
We've had to deal with this before where if you know you're going to do some sort of analytical technique, if you find a certain type of thing, the minute you find that thing, you have to go into like almost clean room mode in right. the dirt.
Yeah.
You can't touch it. You can't breathe on it. You really don't want anything, any air on it.
Mm-hmm.
You want to collect that in as pure of a way as possible. And the best way to do it is to collect all the dirt around it and then do it in a lab in a clean environment.
Yeah.
But if you can't do that, you got to extract it in a way that you try not to contaminate whatever it is you're trying to find.
Yeah. You don't want to transfer like your lunch meat molecules onto right. the pottery and then have that pop up in a later study because nobody thought to tell people to put gloves on when they're collecting shards or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, the second place, of course, is the lab.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's lots of things that could contaminate a sample in the lab. So
anyway,
really good article. Very thorough. Check some of the links out. There's some really good things that this actually links to. It was impressive how thorough this was. You got to see the pictures of the
baby bottles. The They're weird baby bottles. Cute.
I don't even know what they're supposed to be. They've got two legs and like a weird head. I don't know if they're kind of bird or something or like, what is this?
They're weird and cute. I love it.
Yeah. Anyway, that's really cool. So check it out and read the article. And if you got any questions, send them over and maybe we'll talk about it on the next episode. So we go from weird bird shapes that kind of look like turkeys to actual turkey. Like, in the next segment.
But like the country, not the animal, to be clear.
To be clear. Back in a minute. Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Z-E-N-C-A-S-T-R. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months or go to zencastr.com and use the code TAS. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on price and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 133. And this is segment two. And as I mentioned, we're in Turkey now. And they should have titled this article, it is titled Headless Statue of Ancient Woman Discovered in Turkey's Mother Goddess City. But what they should have titled it was First Canceled Woman Discovered in Turkey.
Oh my God.
A la 2020.
Wow.
The statue's been toppled and its head's been taken off. This lady was canceled.
Yeah. Possible. The whole city might have been canceled though. And like that was just a byproduct of it.
Yeah.
So
first off, they say Turkey's mother goddess city. That's what the city is known as. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the actual Turkish name for this city is, but I mean, they call it Metropolis. And that sounds like, isn't that where Superman like lives? Metropolis?
It does sound like a superhero city.
Superman or Batman or something. No, Batman's Gotham City. Yeah. Superman, I'm pretty sure it's Metropolis.
Yeah, so that sounds right.
Yeah.
Well,
I know. Anyway, the head's not anywhere to be found. Now, they did just find this, so maybe the head's there somewhere.
Yeah.
I don't know. But they kind of slammed this thing out. And there's actually video of it in the article, which is pretty cool.
Oh my gosh. The video is so cool. And for any of you guys who aren't archaeologists, you should definitely go watch it because I think there's a lot of mystery around how you excavate something like this because, you know, sometimes on TV you see people just like hulking things out of the ground or whatever. That movie, what was the movie? The Sutton Hoo movie?
Sutton Hoo movie.
Yeah. Yeah, the Sutton Hoo movie that we watched did a pretty good job of showing how real excavation would go. But this is real archaeologists really excavating and there's some jump cuts and stuff in there. They don't show the whole thing, but it's pretty true to form. Like they even have some hammers and stuff in there because they had to get some big chunks of soil and rock and stuff out of the way. And like, that's legit how it goes sometimes. So it was really neat to watch that video. And it's a cool thing to watch if you haven't seen or experienced that kind of digging before.
Yeah. It looks like just judging from, you know, the pictures and stuff with people sitting next to digging next to the statue, that the statue is basically life size.
Mm-hmm.
So not huge, you know, probably about the size, probably a little bigger than the woman would have been, you know, more than likely. It's very well preserved. It depicts a woman wearing flowing draped clothing. And aside from the head missing, looks pretty good.
Yeah. So, if you watch to the end of the video, they show a photo of it standing upright and it is really neat. And it's definitely some really, really artistic and really well done stonework. And you and I have been to like the Museum of Pompeii. It's Pompeii.
Well, Naples.
Yeah. Oh, was it in Naples? Okay. Yeah. The stonework, especially where you can see like the flowing garment on top of a body. It's just insane to see how well done that stuff is sometimes. And this one does look like it's pretty good craftsmanship.
Yeah. So the city itself is located 28 miles from the ancient port city of Ephesus, which we'll come into a little bit later here. That'll be important. But to date, on this site, they've been digging there for quite some time. Archaeologists found artifacts and structures from the classical, Hellenistic, Roman, Byzantine, and Ottoman periods. And I'm going to talk about those a little bit later. But they also found, I thought this was really cool. I've literally never heard of something like this being found, but I'm not like a Roman archaeologist. They found a wrestling hall. Like, yeah. How do you know that? Yeah. What about an indicated wrestling hall? The Romans like to paint pictures of the thing that was happening on the wall because of the multi-languages that were there.
Yeah.
Maybe
that's
that was it.
That's probably how. Yeah, that's neat.
But I don't know how you determine Roman wrestling from like a brothel. Like, are those pictures very similar? Like, I don't really know.
Well, there's probably two men, number one.
Hey, Romans were kind of like, yes, be with whoever you want.
That's true. That's true. But I'm not sure that they painted pictures of being with whoever you want.
I mean, they kind of did. I remember when I was in the Navy, and I don't think we saw this when we were in Pompeii, but I never forget seeing one of the brothels. They love showing the Navy guys on tour, the brothels, of course. But they showed us one, and it was basically because Pompeii was such an international city where people from all around would come there. You can't expect to speak the language, and they literally had pictures of what you want to do. And there were pictures of women on women action, men on men action.
Yeah.
You know, men and boys. I mean, they had pretty much whatever you wanted to have
up
there.
You just point at the picture.
You just point at what you want.
I want
and
that.
It's like a menu. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, Metropolis was built in the 3rd century BC when the region was under the control of the Seleucid Empire. I don't know how to pronounce that. The golden age of the city was during the Hellenistic period, and it was a religious power center during the Byzantine period. Now, there's something interesting about those periods we're going to get to in a minute. The statue suggests that it was made at a time when Rome controlled Anatolia, and Anatolia was the name of the part of Turkey that is on the Asian continent, because as a lot of people probably know, Turkey is one of those few cities, not Turkey, but
the
Turkey, the country does, but Istanbul is one of those cities that straddles.
Oh, yeah.
Two continents.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it separates right there from the European continent and the Asian continent.
Right.
So anyway, Ephesus, as I mentioned before, the ancient port city was the capital of that region in 133 BC. So for the Roman Empire of that region, Ephesus was the capital.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's important. So I don't know if this woman is going to end up being some kind of politician or if it's just a god. I mean, a goddess don't recognize?
Yeah, they were saying that it's the mother goddess city, so it might be that this is a statue of the mother goddess.
But why toppled and headless? Because that doesn't sound very...
No, but it could have happened by accident. We can't assume that it was angrily toppled.
I think there's significant earthquakes in that area, too.
Yeah.
All the time, so...
True. And I didn't see, but... If there was a time when the city was abandoned and there weren't people living there or weren't a lot of people living there, that would have been a good point for something natural to happen that caused it to fall over and break. But then like, where's the head too?
Right.
Or did somebody carry it off? It is weird that the head is missing.
It's weird that it might just not be found yet. Like I said,
That's true. Yeah.
So, cause this was very recent. This didn't come from a paper. This is literally like from the news.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, that's about it from the article, but I did do just a very surface research to give you some general dates on those periods that I mentioned earlier. Most of these overlap, but I thought it was interesting that, you know, they were represented. Now, it's possible that, you know, these different periods actually happened successively at this city, but the period itself more broadly overlaps quite a bit.
Right, right. Because those borders are constantly shrinking and expanding. Depending on what's going on militaristically speaking and all that.
Right.
Yeah.
Now the classical period, they say goes from 8th century BC to 6th century AD. And this is classical Roman really, because Rome started around 8th century BC and then the Roman Empire was done around the 5th century AD. So I guess it went from classical to, you know, just basic good old fashioned Rome after that. I don't know. But,
Well, Rome basically fell after that point. The Roman Empire did. It wasn't really a power after.
Right.
It wasn't a world power at that point.
But there's a Roman period, which we'll talk about later.
Oh, okay.
So anyway, the Hellenistic period, I didn't know this was so specific, dates generally from 323 BC, the death of Alexander the Great, to 31 BC, Battle of Actium, and the emergence of the bigger Roman Empire. So Rome was established 8th century BC and the empire itself, they were already starting to expand, But I think the Battle of Actium is what made them an empire in their own eyes.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah,
from the sounds of it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably getting this all wrong.
This is all very confusing.
I know, right?
And we are not classical archaeologists, no. So...
The Roman period was from, again, 8th century BC to about 5th century AD when the Roman Empire essentially fell. And then the Byzantine Empire was from about 330, again, about the give or take the death of Alexander the Great, to about the 1450s or so. Mm. And then the Ottoman Empire went from about that time period, 14th century, to the 20th century.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But I feel like that one's continuing to go because we literally have an Ottoman right here. So is that just like a throwback? Or man, you don't give me anything.
Oh
man.
But that one was like really bad though.
I know.
Yeah, that all that stuff with the dates is really confusing. I don't understand how the different time periods play together. So maybe that's some fodder for a future episode. We can pick apart the Roman.
Just a whole episode about time periods.
Yeah, the Roman one in particular, because there's so many different layers to it. And it was so big and so spread out that I'm sure there's a lot to go over there. So.
All right. Well, I think because of that Ottoman joke that I made, we need to end this segment. We're going to go to segment 3, where I take up work in the salt mines, but it's not all that bad because I get to have some lamb chops. Back in a minute. You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 133, the third and final segment. And as promised, we're going to go to a salt mine, an Iranian salt mine to be exact. I didn't even know they were mining salt in Iran, but there you go, Iranian salt mine. So the cool thing about this is this site's been excavated since, well, I think before 1993. We'll get to that in a little bit. So there have been excavations here for a long time. And one of the things that was just recently found were basically mummified sheep, 1,600-year-old mummified sheep. Mm-hmm. And they were naturally mummified.
Yeah, I was going to say naturally mummified in the salt mine.
Right. So one of the cool things about this and why this is a paper, and for this one, by the way, they link to the peer-reviewed study from the Royal Society, and we have that in the show notes. So you can take a look at that.
It was very, very...
It's very technical.
Very technical.
Yeah.
Read the abstract. But it's very technical.
The article does a really good job of distilling it down into the bullet points.
Yeah,
it definitely does. So it does a really good job with that.
Yep.
So anyway, they were able to pull DNA from this. And the cool thing about the DNA from these sheep was that ancient DNA, and this would be considered ancient for sure, is usually very fragmented and damaged. And you just got to kind of like piece it together and you might not have all the pieces.
Are you telling me Jurassic Park can't really happen?
I mean, no. See, okay, so Jurassic Park...
Oh, no. Here we go. Tangent.
Do you remember why Jurassic Park really happened? Because they said that they bred only females, I think it was. There were no males.
Uh-huh.
So you couldn't actually have them breeding in captivity.
Right.
But they used frog DNA to supplement some of the places where they were missing DNA.
Oh, that's right.
And I think the connotation is some of the dinosaurs were able to basically... replicate an amphibious type behavior where the females were able to have like unfertilized eggs.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. So.
All right. Well, that was.
You brought that up.
I did. I brought that on us all.
So anyway.
You're welcome.
So anyway, but, we've got crazy female sheep that are breeding in by themselves in these weird labs. So I don't know what's going on.
Okay. Yeah. Can I go back to dinosaurs for like a quick second though?
Ahead.
Do you think
I'm an archaeologist.
Do you think that there might be a salt flat or a salt mine somewhere that has preserved a dinosaur that might have some intact DNA that we could extract and have Jurassic Park? Or is it just too old?
I mean, I don't know who was mining salt when the dinosaurs were alive.
I don't mean salt mine. I mean natural salt deposit.
Well, possibly, but I think the problem with that is...
It's too old.
No. It's that the mine itself is excavated, so things can like fall into it.
Yeah.
And things can go into it and then become in the salty environment. Whereas with salt not being mined 65 plus million years ago, there's no way for like a dinosaur to like fall into that much salt.
Yeah, that's true.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
No, it's not That's not saying that there aren't fragments of, you know, dinosaurs maybe that have been preserved, but I think even 65 million years is asking quite a lot.
It is asking
And that's
a lot.
Right at the edge of dinosaurs, yeah. Right? Really, you're talking like 100 to 200 million years. So anyway.
All right. Well, that's been our paleontological tangent for the day. Moving on.
There you go. Anyway, the DNA here, because the salt helped to preserve it, was in better condition with longer fragment lengths and less damage. So we'll talk a little bit more about the sheep that they looked at in the DNA in a bit here. Again, the preservation was due to the salt mine, and the salt mine was called Shahrabad. I'm not really sure how to pronounce
Shahrabad.
That. Shahrabad. I don't know.
I'm not sure either.
Yeah. Either way, it's in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
So the cool thing is, going back to what I mentioned earlier, 1993, six men dated from about 1700 years ago, so prior to when the sheep fell in, were found and retained much of their original features.
Yeah,
it said aspects of their original features.
Yeah, I think hair and skin and stuff like that, which is creepy and amazing.
I know. And the way this works basically is salt absorbs the water from the corpse, preventing soft tissues from breaking down and decaying. And I think a similar process happens with like bog bodies and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It's just anything that can stop or prevent or slow down decay will preserve a body.
Right.
And that's what mummification does. Purposeful mummification.
Right.
They just take out all those soft things and put them in jars and then, you know, salt them up probably. Anyway, the cool thing is they found that the sheep were genetically similar to modern sheep breeds, which genetics changes pretty quick, especially with domesticated animals.
Yeah.
And if the genes were genetically similar to modern sheep breeds, that is almost unequivocal that there have been sheep in that area for at least 1600 years.
Mm-hmm.
And if they had, you know, sheep back then that were similar to the sheep now, you can just assume that it was probably well before that they had sheep as well.
Right.
So, yeah, that's pretty neat.
Mm-hmm.
They also they said that they created what they call a genetic impression of the sheep using the DNA to create an image of what the animal would have looked like while it was alive.
Right.
And I guess the old DNA lacked a gene variant for a woolly coat. I thought all sheep had woolly coats, but I guess it lacked it for a woolly coat. And it said it did have hair fiber on its body consistent with several modern breeds, though.
Yeah, I think what they were getting at with that is that this particular sheep was not bred for its coat and therefore its wool potential, right? So they weren't using these sheep like that. These were probably food sheep.
There's a lot of feta down there. So
yeah,
I'm just saying.
Yeah, food, milk, that's what the sheep were for. But it does seem like they probably did have sheep that were bred specifically for their wool because they were making clothing out of wool at that time too. So it's interesting because it shows that in this area at that time, they had specialized flocks for different types of things. So,
well, it definitely doesn't take once you have domesticated animals, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that, hey, when that animal has sex with that animal, you get this animal.
Yeah.
That is something I think pretty much anyone would come to that conclusion.
Right.
And when they start seeing certain types of coats or certain traits that they want to propagate, they'll just start breeding those together.
Yeah. We'll just put them in one field and the others in another, or even on different hilltops, you know, just enough to keep them apart. And then all of a sudden you have different flocks that are specialized in different things. And I don't know a whole lot about sheep and what kind of meat or milk they produce, but it does make me wonder if
lamb chops.
Right. But it does make me wonder if there was a specific flavor or type of meat that they were breeding for. I mean, you could breed for coats really easily and get your wool sheep, you know, to one side. But then with the rest of them, were they trying to get a certain quality which made better milk, more milk maybe some variety just had better lactation, so therefore more milk? I don't know. It'd be interesting. Yeah. Maybe looking at current sheep herding groups would give you some of those answers, because I don't know anything about how that works.
It makes me kind of wonder if modern sheep that are bred for their coats, if they're also, I don't know, if they're only bred for their coats, or if at some point you can just eat them.
I believe they are only bred for their coats.
So when they age out?
Yeah, when they age out, I mean, they just die naturally. And I think they do hit a certain age where the coat is not necessarily good for spinning anymore. And I don't know what they do with those at that point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe they, I don't know what they would be good for at that point. But
Stew?
I don't know.
If I had a sheep, I would name it Stew.
Oh,
what now?
That's so sad. What? But so funny.
Come here, Stu.
Little Stewie. Anyway, all right. Well, that was a mean joke.
All right. So that's pretty much it for this week. We've got some good articles already on the slate for next week. So come on back for that. And we're starting our travels again. So who knows where we're going to be?
Yeah, definitely. I mean,
we actually know where we're going to be.
We do, but we're not going to reveal it yet. It's a big surprise.
Actually, if you want to follow us, check out Roadster Adventures on Instagram.
Yeah.
We post some stuff over there and we'll link to like YouTube videos and stuff. That's just kind of an aside.
Yeah.
But we talk about it a lot, so I figured I'd mention it. And Roadster is a combination of our last names. So it's R-O-D-S-T-E-R, not R-O-A-D.
Right.
So. Yeah, go find that. Anyway, thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.
Adios.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening, and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.